Gravity had a good run, but it's time to feel the weightlessness of the Brooks Glycerin 21. These running shoes feature nitrogen-infused DNA Loft V3 cushioning. Brooks has even magnified the plushness to elevate the softness to new levels. And if you want extra support, find these same features in the Brooks Glycerin GTS 21. Learn more and shop now at brooksrunning.com. That's brooksrunning.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Last week, a pair of widely circulated videos appeared to show Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg delivering an ominous message about his social media platform.
I wish I could keep telling you that our mission in life is connecting people, but it isn't. We just want to predict your future behaviors. Spectre showed me how to manipulate you into sharing intimate data about yourself and all those you love for free. The more you express yourself, the more we own you.
Now, of course, that is just the audio. If you were able to see the audio along with the actual video of Zuckerberg, you'd think, hey, that's Mark Zuckerberg talking about controlling the world's information. But it was not Zuckerberg. It wasn't even real, even though it looked and sounded just like him. The video was a deep fake. Digitally manipulated videos where what you see and hear never actually happened, but they're almost indistinguishable from real videos. Well, last week, California Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff and House Intelligence Committee Chair sounded the alarm.
Thinking ahead to 2020 and beyond, one does not need any great imagination to envision even more nightmarish scenarios that would leave the government, the media, and the public struggling to discern what is real and what is fake.
And as the technology improves, it is getting harder and harder to tell the difference. So this hour on Point, the rise of deep fakes and what to do about it. And you can join us. Have you seen one of these videos? Have you been fooled by a deep fake? Are we ready to understand, absorb, and even combat this type of technology? What does it say about us, our media consumption, and the information ecosystem we now inhabit? And could deepfake videos where it's getting harder to actually believe your eyes, what impact is that going to have on democracy, on our conceptions of reality? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we'll start today in Berkeley, California, with Hani Farid. He is a professor of computer science and electrical engineering at the University of California, Berkeley. His research focuses on digital forensic, image analysis, and human perception. Hani Farid, welcome to On Point.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Okay, so I gave sort of the introductory version of what a deep fake is. How would you describe deep fakes?
Yeah, the term deep fake is sort of a catch-all for what is technically called AI synthesized content. Not quite as catchy, but more accurate. And what this refers to is using the latest advances in artificial intelligence and machine learning to completely automatically synthesize these fake images and fake videos. Because, of course, we've always been able to manipulate videos and audios and images, but it's required skill and time and effort. And what we've done is the classic story of automation. And so what we do is we feed into these systems images and videos, and there are three types of deepfake videos that you should know about. The so-called lip-sync deepfake, that's the Zuckerberg one that you saw, where you take a video of somebody saying something, you insert a new audio track, and then you just replace the mouth of the original video to be consistent with that new audio. And in some ways, that's very powerful because only the part of the mouth is being manipulated and altered. And literally, you're putting words into somebody's mouth. And the second is so-called a face swap deepfake. Mm-hmm. If you search for deepfake in Nick Cage, you will see the performer Nick Cage in many movies that he never starred in, where essentially one person's face is replaced with another person's face. And again, that's done fully automatically. And the third type is what is so-called a puppet master deepfake, where you take a single image of a person, and then you have an actor, or me, or you, sitting in front of a computer, and as you move your face and your mouth, it reanimates the picture of that person, essentially treating them like a puppet. And then on top of those three deepfake videos that I just enumerated, there's very, very powerful technology to now synthesize audio in the voice of a person. So you would train, for example, a system to learn what President Trump sounds like, and then you would type at the computer and it would synthesize audio for you. And now you see how you put those two pieces together and literally make video of people saying and doing things that they never did.
Wow. I just want to assure everyone right now that this is actually me. We're not using a deep fake yet for radio hosts. But Hani Farid, This technology actually sounds absolutely fascinating and very, very powerful. But where did it emerge from? I mean, everything that you're describing, it sounds like, was it initially sort of for movie making, for Hollywood? Where did this AI synthesis, automated synthesis of video and sound imagery come from?
You're absolutely right. And so this field, it's primarily computer graphics and computer vision, has been around for many decades. And the fields have always been interested in developing technologies that allow us to manipulate images and video, primarily for things like special effects and artistic purposes. And while we've always had some concerns about things like Photoshop and Adobe After Effects that allow us to manipulate images or video, they've always had a human in the loop that typically required a lot of skill. And so the advances of the last few years in so-called machine learning and in particular deep learning, where the term deep fakes comes from, has automated and democratized access to those tools. And in many ways, that's the new threat. It's not so much that we can manipulate images and video and audio. It's that you've democratized access to it. These technologies are online. You can download the software for free.
I could just do that right now.
You can go online, you can go to a so-called GitHub repository, and you can download the code and run it on your laptop. And right now, it's not producing the highest quality. You need a little bit of skill to create the higher quality fakes. But what we've seen over the last year and a half, is every 3 to 6 months, the technology improves, the software improves. It's the classic story of technology, of course. And now you are putting into the hands of millions the ability to create these. And I think it's also important to understand that in the hands of those millions is also the ability to distribute it. So the fake is not so much a threat were it not for the Facebook, YouTubes, and Twitters of the world, where I can put eyes on it to the tune of millions instantaneously. And so we have to think about those two, both the production and the distribution, and then, of course, the consumption, which we have an all-too-willing public that is moving very, very fast on these platforms, consuming digital content at an alarming rate, and is often gullible and susceptible to this type of content.
Well, I want to play a video that lots of people saw just last month, and ask you if this falls into it falls under the umbrella of these deep fakes, because this is the doctored video of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi that went viral. And so, in this clip that we're going to play, CBS's Chief Justice and Homeland Security correspondent Jeff Pegues, he compares the real video and the fake video during a report for CBS.
Since we took the majority.
Here is the real video of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
And then he had a press conference in the Rose Garden with all this short sort of visuals.
Now the doctored video in which she appears to be impaired.
And then he had a press conference in the Rose Garden with all this short sort of visuals.
So, Hanif Farid, is that a deep fake or is this a doctored video?
It is not a deep fake. It is what I call a shallow or even a dumb fake. It was really very simple. They just slowed the video down by about 75%, and they tweaked the tone of the audio a little bit, and it had the effect of making Speaker Pelosi sound impaired. And what was interesting about that video was a couple of things. One was how simple of a manipulation and how much of an impact it had on how we interpreted the video. But also what was interesting is Facebook's response to it. So to the tune of 3 million views on Facebook, Facebook kept insisting that they are not going to take it down because it doesn't violate their terms of service. And I think that's problematic for a couple of reasons. That video was not satire. It was not political commentary. It was the classic definition of fake news. It was designed to harm the speaker, and it was being pushed as real news. And what I found particularly puzzling about Facebook's response is that if you read their terms of service, the rules of their platform, it says that you're not allowed to post things that are misleading or fraudulent. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand how you can look at that video, which is a clear-cut misleading and fraudulent, and say this doesn't violate our terms. And as we come into the lead-up to the 2020s, I think this was the canary in the coal mine. It showed in very stark terms that the social media platforms are not ready to deal with at-scale misinformation campaigns. And that is particularly troubling since we know this problem existed in 2016 and they have had 4 years to get their house in order, and it doesn't appear that they have.
So I do want to explore more with you the idea of sort of the ecosystem that we find ourselves in. But to play devil's advocate here for a second, are there any positive uses for deepfake technology?
Good. You should ask that question. It's the right question to ask. And of course, the answer is yes. I think Hollywood studios, it's a boom for them. So, for example, they can now create, for example, dubbed movies where you have somebody speaking in English and then you have an actor speaking in Spanish. And then the actor in the original movie, their mouth will move completely correct with the Spanish language or whatever other language you want. And that's neat. That's really cool. And that's nice for us. They have the ability, for example, to put a young Harrison Ford into a movie by doing a face swap. There's really interesting applications and there's fun applications. I love seeing the Nick Cage in all the movies, including The Sound of Music. It's highly entertaining. But the question you want to ask next is, what's on the other side? So when in any technology, there's a positive side and a negative side. And now the question we have to ask ourselves is, what is the balance of those? And as you said into the lead-in, this could be potentially an existential threat to our democracy. It can be an existential threat to how we acquire information online, what we can trust and what we cannot. And imagine a world where everything can be fake. Well, then nothing is real. And mm-hmm. everybody has plausible deniability to say, well, that's simply not real. And now we have a really interesting landscape. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, we're purportedly in the information age over the last few decades. But we shouldn't confuse that with the knowledge age. And information is not necessarily knowledge. And I think we have to start moving away from information age into knowledge age. And I think we have to get a handle on these technologies in order to do that.
Yeah. So we'll talk more about that. But to your point about, can it shift our sense of reality? I mean, that Dr. Pelosi video, as sort of, you know, unsophisticated as it was, enough people believed it, I think, for it to show that it takes very little, actually, to move people's sense of what is real.
You're absolutely right. And I'm still getting mail from people insisting that it's real. And here's the thing. You can go to C-SPAN and watch the original video. And so even with overwhelming evidence that that video is fake, people have been convinced. And it's maybe even a little worse for that, because after 3 million views, some people never see the correction. And so once the cat is out of the bag, you can't really correct the record.
Well, we are talking this hour about deepfake technology or AI automated synthetic media. I'm going to call it that for now. And what impact it has on our democracy, it could have on our democracy, and how to be sure that we can retain a sense of what is real and what is not. Are there technological solutions to that? Political solutions? We'll explore that when we come back in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about deep fakes, and I'm wondering if you've seen them. These are videos that are altered with AI to make people say things they've never said, do things they've never do, possibly even, or they've never done, or possibly even be places they've never been. And what effect this increasingly sophisticated technology and the ability to manipulate images like that, what effect that has on us as individuals and our ability to perceive reality, what effect it has on our democracy. I'm joined this hour by Hani Farid. He's a professor of computer science and electrical engineering at the University of California, Berkeley. Well, let's listen. Of course, this is a very visual thing, but I want to listen to a little bit of another deepfake video. This is one from last year where comedian Jordan Peele created a deepfake of former President Obama as part of a public service announcement that Peele made warning against the dangers of synthetic media and fake news.
This is a dangerous time. Moving forward, we need to be more vigilant with what we trust from the internet. That's a time when we need to rely on trusted news sources. It may sound basic, but how we move forward in the age of information is going to be the difference between whether we survive or whether we become some kind of f-ed up dystopia.
That's comedian Jordan Peele. not former President Barack Obama. But in the video, it looks as if it's the first half of the video. It looks as if it's President Obama speaking. Let's just take a quick call here. Max is calling from Two Rivers, Wisconsin. Max, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I have seen a number of these deepfake videos, and I see that there are some upsides with, you know, using certain actors' faces in movies. It's also been used for, like, comedic purposes. They did Sylvester Stallone's face on Arnold Schwarzenegger in Terminator 2, and I think that's just really funny, but there is a darker side to this, that what if in a few years, as the development gets better and better, and as they start to make it sound more realistic, because I still feel like there's a little bit of a range here that we're in right now where it's still in the uncanny valley, what if in a few years they're able to replicate, you know, political leaders, national leaders? And what if somebody, some cyber hacker, decides to make a deep fake of somebody, you know, maybe not Trump or whoever, you know, calling in a nuclear strike or something. I mean, obviously that's worst case scenario, but it's a possibility.
Right, Max. Exactly. I mean, that's exactly the point. That's what we want to explore here. So thank you so much for your call. To help us answer that question, I'm going to welcome into the conversation now Aviv Ovadia, joining us in the studio. Aviv is founder of the Thoughtful Technology Project. He's also non-resident fellow at the German Marshall Fund's Alliance for Securing Democracy and former chief technologist at the University of Michigan Center for Social Media Responsibility. Aviv, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me on.
So first, let's answer the question from the caller just now. Could we reach a point with this deepfake technology where a hacker or even a foreign government is creating videos that purportedly show another leader or military leader doing something they've never done?
Definitely. That's already possible.
Already possible. I'm about to ask you a question. Are we sure it hasn't already happened?
We can't be sure, but it would probably be something that we would know sooner or later.
Okay, but how we would know because the person being portrayed would say, "I never did that."
Yeah, I mean, okay. I think there's going to be controversy if someone is set to be doing something that they never did before.
Okay, so you heard a little earlier, Professor Farid talking about sort of his concerns about deepfakes. Do you share those concerns?
Yes, definitely. I think that there's significant negative impacts both of the technology and even of the existence of the technology, regardless of whether or not it's even used.
Okay. So tell us then more about what the Thoughtful Technology Project is trying to do regarding deepfakes.
I mean, it's sort of an umbrella for work that where the real goal is to ensure that technological developments in general don't irreversibly harm our information ecosystem. And there's three sort of thrusts to that. Advocating, advising, and instigating. So advocating for mitigations to some of these threats because there is no silver bullet.
Mm-hmm.
Advising, so helping work with platforms and policymakers to ensure that we have the tools in place before things get bad. And instigating, demonstrating what types of solutions could actually work in particular cases and not necessarily in directly addressing the deepfake videos, but in, for example, putting media literacy in the hands of people through the platforms themselves that are actually the distribution mechanisms for these videos and audio.
Okay. I'm going to ask you and Professor Farid the same question here for a second. Not to dwell too much in the darkness here, but we're having this conversation because of the concerns around deepfakes. I mean, Aviv, what is your nightmare scenario?
So I have sort of three ways of thinking about this. There's this what we just sort of heard, this what I call the explosive public fakery, where you have something with like real geopolitical or election implications that is irreversible. You cause some real harm due to the fakery itself and the fakery on a large public scale. You also have your just sort of tipping point into reality apathy. This is that death of a thousand cuts where you can't hold people accountable to the things they actually have said anymore. I think that's at least as big of a threat as the real threat of fakery. And because you can't really run a democracy well if you can't have accountability. And finally, there's this idea of sort of individual trickery, but at scale. So think about all the scams and fraud that use, you know, they already are people who are scammed all the time by robocalls that say, oh, you know, your kid is like, or I'm calling as your son and you can't really hear because you're like, maybe your hearing isn't so great and you need to bail them out. And so you send a bunch of money over some wire service. And what happens if that gets so good that it doesn't just trick someone who's hard of hearing and someone who's maybe not quite as aware of what's going on in the world?
So, Hani Farid, three scenarios there from Aviv Ovadia. Your nightmare scenario?
I agree with Aviv. I am worried about the national security, geopolitical issues. I'm also worried about disruption of democratic elections. I'm worried that 24, 48 hours before a national election, either here or abroad, fake video comes out before anybody gets around to figuring out that it's fake and correcting the record. We have a manipulation of our election. I'm also worried about the fraud that Aviv pointed out, but also there's fraud at a much larger scale. Imagine a day before an IPO, actually imagine an hour before an IPO, and a fake video comes out of the CEO saying something damaging. You can have fraud to the tune of billions of dollars. And the last thing I'll add, and this is not actually a nightmare scenario, it's actually already happening, and it's more personal, which is the use of this technology for non-consensual pornography. Mm-hmm. We are seeing really troubling use of this technology to take usually women, typically Hollywood performers, and inserting them into hardcore pornography videos and then distributing those. And I see that as, you know, yet another attack of women, particularly online. And it's a very troubling trend. And I think we're going to have to start thinking about everything from the national security issues to the democratic elections to the fraud to these issues of how to protect women online.
Right. So we're going to talk now about sort of what we can do about it. Because the truth is, with any issue surrounding technology, the genie's already out of the bottle. We're not gonna stop the development of technology. But how can we thoughtfully keep up our human social systems, our political and legal systems around the technology as it develops? That's really, I think, one of the big things that the emergence of deep fake technology is forcing us to ask yet again. And in fact, during last week's House Intelligence Committee hearing, they talked about deep fake videos, and Ohio Republican Congressman Brad Wenstrup proposed a few ways to perhaps push back against deepfakes and the intentional spread of misinformation from both foreign and domestic actors.
That may be what we have to do. Slow it down, triage it. This is not verified. This is satire. And maybe on a global scale, when it comes to punitive measures to people that are doing things nefarious, maybe we have to have international extradition laws. Because when something comes from some other country, maybe even a friendly country, that defames and hurts someone here, maybe we both agree amongst those nations that we'll extradite those people and they can be punished in your country for what they did to one of your citizens.
That's Ohio Republican Congressman Brad Wenstrup at last week's House Intelligence Committee hearing. Well, joining us now from Washington is Representative Yvette Clark, Democrat from New York. She represents New York's 9th District, and she's introduced a bill that would attempt to combat the spread of disinformation through restrictions on so-called deepfake video technology. Representative Clark, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, Representative, tell us, what inspired you to introduce this bill?
I have established, along with a number of my colleagues here on the Hill, a multicultural media caucus. And we had begun doing some workshops on some of the emerging threats, particularly facing communities of color. And one of our panelists actually brought the issue of revenge porn to us, and the idea that women of color have been really targeted by revenge porn. And it's extended to women, generally speaking, that there's been a very heavy emphasis on women of color. And in having an unpacking the whole idea of what it means to the individual, we took it even further to look at what it means for a democratic civil society,
right?
Whether that is the impact on it could have on elections or inciting violence. These were concerns that immediately came to mind, knowing how deceptive deepfake videos can be, in that, you know, it's very hard to detect it
exactly
with the naked eye.
Yeah. So then, Representative Clark, what does your bill propose to do to contain that possibility or prevent that possibility from happening?
Well, one of the things that it would do is it would require that content providers, assuming that these are individuals who, mean well, but have, decided that this is a niche area that they want to use their craft in, it requires them to contain a digital watermark of some sort or a disclaimer, both video or audio, so that the American people can distinguish between what has been manufactured and is a fake creation versus something that is, a true-to-form video, truthful in nature.
Mm-hmm. So, Aviv Ovadia, let me just turn back to you for a moment. Would something like requiring a digital watermark be an effective solution?
I think it is valuable. I mean, it doesn't solve the broad scope of every issue, but if there are ways to ensure that that the tool makers that are able to put this on a billion phones around the world, that they sort of they require those watermarks by default within that when you're creating a fake, I think that could be very valuable.
Okay. And Hani Farid, I mean, we have an elected representative on the line, a member of Congress here. What would you advise her in terms of of what needs to be in the bill in order to really make a difference here in controlling the impact of deepfakes?
Yeah, I think Representative Clark is absolutely right that some type of watermarking is a good first step, where the people who are creating these technologies would be asked or potentially required to insert watermarks. There's a few things you should understand. Those watermarks are not inherently non-reversible. So there are ways of attacking those systems, and we should understand that. We should also understand that some of the software is being developed by now, U.S. And friendly academics who we can get on board. But, of course, there are adversaries out there who are not going to conform to these rules. I'll also point out that there are other ways to attack this problem. So one way to attack it is how do you detect the fake content? The other way is how do you create more trusted content? And there are actually very nice technological solutions of so-called control capture systems, where when you record an image or a video or an audio, it cryptographically signs that content, puts that signature on the blockchain, which is a distributed immutable ledger, and that way you can authenticate the content at any point in the future. And so I think we have to think about both of these directions. How do we create more trusted content? And then how do we detect fake content? And the last thing I'll add is we also have to insist that the social media companies do better at enforcing their rules, mm-hmm. because many of their rules are very good about revenge porn and non-consensual porn and misleading and fraudulent material, but they're not doing a very good job of enforcing those rules. And I think we also have to put pressure on them to do better.
Well, Representative Clark, I mean, lots of suggestions there from several experts in this field. I'm curious about whether you feel that your fellow members of Congress understand sort of the depth of the potential problem here, because this is one of the questions I think a lot of people have when Congress tries to grapple with our technological present and future. Do our legislative leaders really get how powerful these technologies can be?
Absolutely. I actually had a very good conversation with some colleagues yesterday, and it doesn't take much to recognize that this is something that we need to get ahead of. And as vice chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee, I felt the need to lead on this because, of course, we're dealing with a myriad of issues. But looking at what's coming down the pipe, looking at what's emerging, particularly in the tech space, has been something that I've been really, really focused on. And it's important to educate the public. It's important to educate colleagues as well. But everyone could agree that watching sort of the distorted video of Nancy Pelosi recently was something that I think alarmed a lot of people. And that was just a little bit of tampering with the video. Deepfakes takes it to a whole nother level and will continue to take it to new levels, which is why it's important that we get ahead of it. One of the things that my legislation will require is that there's actually a new federal criminal offense established when someone knowingly doesn't disclose that they have they have used deepfake technology.
Uh-huh.
It subjects the individual to imprisonment for serious violations, such as inciting violence and election interference or revenge porn, as well as civil penalties. It also gives individuals a private right of action for certain victims to sue deepfake creators in violation of the watermark or disclosure requirements. So we're also providing some tools.
Right.
It requires DOJ to designate regional deepfake coordinators. I mean, it's really building out an infrastructure because, you know, deepfakes, it's not only a domestic issue, but because we're all connected via social media through the internet.
That's right.
It's a global.
Well, Representative Yvette Clark, Democrat of New York, talking to us about a bill that she is introducing or has introduced that would attempt to combat the spread of these the disinformation through deepfake videos. With us from Washington, Representative Clark, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
Well, we've got to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll take a lot of our callers who have things they want to say about deep fakes and the impact they can have on our perception of reality and our democracy. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about deep fake videos. These are the artificial intelligence enhanced or synthesized videos that can make people pretty much say and do and be places they've never been before. And we're talking about the impact of these deep fake videos or deep fake technology on our very perception of reality and what that might do to our democracy. I'm joined today by Hanif Farid. He's a professor of computer science and electrical engineering at the University of California at Berkeley. And Aviv Ovadia joins us. He's the founder of the Thoughtful Technology Project. And let's listen to a little bit more of a hearing that was held by the House Intelligence Committee just last week about deepfakes. Florida Democratic Congresswoman Val Demings said she's worried about foreign entities or other malicious actors using the technology to wreak havoc in the United States.
Fake information is a problem. But the other problem is it creates an environment where good people no longer believe the good guys. And boy, are we seeing that in our country right now. That's a major problem. Our institutions that we have grown to depend on and believe in are no longer being believed. And that can create total chaos.
Aviv, I know that you paid close attention to the hearing last week. I mean, were you satisfied by what you heard or about the extent of understanding that the representatives were showing about deepfakes?
I mean, I think the point of that hearing was really to educate, and I think it did a pretty good job of sort of laying out the set of issues and the challenges that we have in face.
So a good start then?
It was a good start.
Okay. Well, Hanif Farid, then respond to what Congresswoman Demings said in that clip there, because I think she's pointing to something very important, that already we're at a somewhat tenuous place in terms of perception, reality, and trust, and that there's the possibility of this new wave of technology to make that even worse.
I agree with the representative. And to sort of give you a sense also how fast this has changed, think back just before the 2016 national election here in the U.S. when the Access Hollywood audio recording came out of then-candidate Trump saying some pretty awful things. Nobody said it was fake. Nobody even thought to say it was fake. And look at how fast and how quickly the landscape has shifted in 2 years. Does anybody think that today, if that tape came out, the president now wouldn't say it was fake? And in fact, he did say it about a year ago, a year after apologizing for it, he said, well, I think it's fake. And that actually tells you something about the ecosystem we're living in. When we are seeing, and this goes well beyond deep fakes, it really is sort of getting at the core of social media and how we get information online, is that we are living in a misinformation age, and the deep fakes are simply an addition to that, a particularly dangerous addition to that. But I agree with the representative, is that where are we going to be when we don't trust the people on NPR, when we don't trust the people at the Washington Post and New York Times, and everybody has their own sense of reality? How do you have a democracy? Imagine the chaos that even individuals, let alone state-sponsored actors, can perform on our societies. And I think it's a troubling trend, and I think, as we've been talking about, there are technological issues. There are corporate issues, the responsibility of the companies. There are legislative issues. And there's also us as citizens have to become better digital citizens. Mm-hmm. We have to get better at consuming digital content online. We have to be able to distinguish between the real and the fake and the trusted and the not trusted. And frankly, we have to slow down. Everybody is simply moving way too fast online, too quick to anger, too quick to react, too quick to be outraged without really doing the due diligence.
Yeah. Well, that will get us again and again, and I will hammer away at this question for the rest of my life about the role of social media companies and their power to slow things down. But Aviv, let me ask you, we have been focused on the United States for obvious reasons here, but we, even in our politically polarized times, we have a fairly robust sort of political and media ecosystems, set of ecosystems. What impact could this kind of technology have in other societies?
Well, we already have the case of Gabon, where you had a coup took place partially, allegedly, because people weren't sure that the current president was alive. And they were like, a video came out and people were wondering, was it a deepfake? Was it not? There's a bunch of complexities to that case, but that's like a very concrete example. And then you also have all of these shallow fakes spreading throughout media ecosystems, both in the U.S. and especially abroad, where they're having very significant impact. You know, everything from leading to lynchings to affecting elections. And as that becomes easier to do, you can imagine worse outcomes.
Wow. So scale and connectivity is a huge part of this issue.
But it's still part of a spectrum. We have to remember that deepfakes, like fake news in general, are not anything that's new. It's simply an increase in scale, an increase in speed. And there might be sort of fundamental shifts that happen as a result of that, or there might not. It might just be more.
But even that sounds a little terrifying, to be perfectly honest. But let's go to our callers. I've been making them wait for quite some time. So Kyle is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Kyle, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Go ahead.
So I guess I'm going to let Professor Fareed explain public key cryptography, because I'm sure he can do it in a much more practiced manner than myself. But I'm glad that the other guest said that this is nothing new. I agree. As a computer science information security guy, the ability to trust something that you have no way to verify is a problem that we have had since the inception of the Internet. And so public key encryption and GPG, that sort of thing, gives us the ability to sign and protect this data, much like the watermarks that you guys have been discussing. So my question is, the DoD has successfully implemented a public key infrastructure across its massive personnel base, and that allows non-repudiation and definitive identification. Do you think that maybe we should consider implementing something like that on a nationwide or perhaps even globally federated basis, and what the challenges and implications of that would be?
Yeah, well, Kyle, thank you so much for your call. So, Professor Fareed, first of all, for those who don't know, PGP encryption, how would you explain it?
So let's just talk about encryption in general, because there's lots of versions of it. So encryption is simply, and particularly in the context of authentication, is that at the point of recording, so on your device, you extract a distinct, a unique signature from the piece of content you recorded, image, video, audio, and you cryptographically sign it, which means that any modification to that content down the line can be detected because you have this encrypted signature. And if you put that signature, as I was saying earlier, onto the blockchain, which all you have to know about that is that it's a distributed immutable ledger. So you don't have to have a trusted third party holding on to these signatures. Then you have a mechanism to authenticate this content down the line. And if this type of technology were built into the Apple phones and the Android phones and all of the devices in the world, we would have a global mechanism for at the point of recording for authenticating every single image and every single video and every single audio. It is not bulletproof. There are some security issues you have to deal with, but it would go a long way to ensuring that. Now, what's the downside? There's privacy issues you have to worry about. Mm. Because if every time I take an image or a video and I put that cryptographic signature onto a blockchain, well, I'm releasing information to the world about every image I took. In some cases, that's good. In some cases, that's bad. And it's sort of the classic story of pitting privacy against security. I think there's probably solutions going down the road. I think you can opt in or opt out from it. So if you want people to trust your content, then you would use it. You can think of it as sort of the flash on your camera. You could either do secure or non-secure. And this would require that, by the way, the technology to do this control capture exists today. It's commercially viable. It's commercially available. I think to make it really secure, you'd have to build it into the hardware of these devices and get it into the hands of the billions of devices out there. And I like this idea a lot because it in some ways, it attacks the problem from a different direction. It doesn't say, how do we detect fake content? It says, how do we create trusted content?
Right.
And that's a really interesting way to think about the problem.
Well, let me get Aviv Avadia's response here. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this is an incredibly important part of a solution. And as you said, there are real privacy implications, and I think we do need to sort through those. But just to look at some of the challenges that we have here, we still can't even ensure that the phone calls that we get are actually coming from the number that they say they are. And so there's a whole suite of problems both at the tech platform layer and at the camera layer and then even at all these other protocols, whether they be phone or email, that we need to be able to address. And you know, ensuring that we keep that sort of chain of custody for content across all of these transformations becomes fairly challenging.
Let's go back to the phones. Scott is calling from Buffalo, New York. Scott, you're on the air.
Hey, Meghna. Just listening to all this, my primary concern with it is now that we're like ramping up on the 2020 election cycle, I just look back to 2016 and how, like on social media, how divisive so many just simple Photoshopped photos or just an image with text under it, how volatile that stuff could be to people and how much discord and drama mm-hmm. it could stoke. So something that's a little more specialized like this that you know, to many people would be more believable than that, just like these very small transactions of distrust and disagreement and frustration, I'm just kind of afraid of how much havoc that could wreak on the political system and just on, you know, social relations between like everyday Americans.
Right.
It's very stressful.
Well, Scott, thank you for your call. I'll be perfectly honest. I'm feeling a little bit of that stress along with you. But that's why we're having this conversation, to figure out how we can all sort of cope with our new reality. Aviv, let me ask you a quick question, because Scott's making me think of one of the things that we learned from, you know, the advent of, quote unquote, fake news in the 2016 election, was how quickly people were willing to share it. Right. Like we're not trained or have the skill set or even the quick tools as individuals when we're using social media to check the validity of the information that we're using. Is that problem not just further magnified or amplified with these deep fakes? Because how would we as individuals affirm the validity of these things?
Right. I think this is a very good question. And I mean, the challenge here is that this is making it much harder to sort of tell fact from fiction. You need to rely much more on trusted sources. What source you trust, you know, those are becoming more and more polarized. And I really see what individuals can do here is only going so far. This is where we really need to be building the sort of authenticity infrastructure. We really need to be relying on expertise and on tools and on trusted sources. And if we're not able to do that, we're not going to be able to sort what's real and what's not.
Hanif Farid, I want to hear from you on this because I've been, you know, reading in the media coverage around deepfakes that there are technologies out there that can try to very quickly assess whether or not it's a faked video or a real video, looking at light, shadows, facial movements, patterns like that. But I mean, I guess what I'm wondering is, nevertheless, no matter how many technological fixes we come up with to manage our technological future, are we already in a place where just like we as human beings are creating an environment that we can't even cope with?
I think you're right. And it's frankly heartbreaking for me to have to say this, but as a technologist, but as good as we get in developing technology to detect these fakes, it's going to have limited application. I mean, at the end of the day, this is a very human problem, which is how do we consume content online and then how do we react to that? And here's my hope. I want to try to be a little hopeful because I'm honestly starting to think about stockpiling food and water. I want to try to be hopeful. And here's what I want to be hopeful about, which is if you think about the internet we know today, it's really 20 years old. I mean, the modern internet. And we are in our infancy of this technology. And we have been moving very, very fast. And I don't think we have been particularly good at being thoughtful about technology. That's us as individuals, our legislators, and frankly, the companies and the platforms. So my hope is that going forward, having these conversations, we are going to start to think about how to have healthier online ecosystems. And that's going to require really fundamental changes, both from the platforms, from our legislators who have to start regulating when it's necessary, and for us as individuals. And I think also we're going to have to start thinking about education. We're going to have to start thinking about how do we educate the next generation of digital consumers. And I say that being very aware that our public schools are overworked and underfunded, and the teachers have way too much to do. But I do think we have to start thinking about curriculum at a very early age to help people understand how to be better digital citizens online.
I mean, I would agree. Teachers already have a lot to do. But if one of the purposes of public education is to grow citizens, who will be leaders of the future, we should try to be preparing them for the future that they're going to enter. That's just my personal opinion here.
I agree. And we can't escape technology. It's here to stay. And there are many wonderful things about it. And it is a game changer. It is democratizing access to information. But we are now starting to see the dark side of it. And we have to come to grips with that.
Aviva Vaidya, jump in here. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that next generation is very important. But it's also true that generation has grown up with Snapchat filters that involve face swaps, right? Which isn't as true for the older generations. It's not as true. And I guess very important to note here is that when you look at who was sharing the most, you know, misinformation during the 2016 election, it wasn't the younger folks. It was the older folks. It was people 60 and up. And I think what we really need to do is that we need to think of a whole society approach to media literacy and really a global approach that specifically focuses on what people in different regions need to know to help understand their civic abilities and how they can make sense of their particular media ecosystem. And that probably has to come from the platforms to some extent because they're the ones who have the eyeballs.
So this is the fourth or fifth time we've mentioned the responsibility that the social media platforms themselves have. I mean, we have 90 seconds left. I just hit this head on. How do we get them to act on this responsibility? I mean, regulation seems to be one of the ways, but is that going to happen? I mean,
the platforms are starting to get more serious about this, and it has been heartening. But there's a lot more that they need to do. Everything from policy changes, design changes, built-in education, technology investment, and really also governance for the platforms at large. All of that needs significant work, and it's happening, but it's happening slowly.
Well, Hanif Farid, we've just got about 30 seconds left here, and before I join you in your bunker with food and water, what is your view on how we can further push the social media platforms?
There are 12 CEOs in the world that can change the online platforms today, and those are the CEOs who advertise on the platforms. They have the control to do this, and they should step up and say, we want a healthier ecosystem and a safer society, and we are going to stop advertising on your platform for 6 months until you get your house in order. Like that, you can change the online worlds.
Well, Hanif Farid, professor of computer science and electrical engineering at the University of California, Berkeley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Aviva Vaidya, founder of the Thoughtful Technology Project and non-resident fellow at the German Marshall Fund's Alliance for Securing Democracy. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.